This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Mark Siddall is a specialist in the kinds of things you probably hope stay the heck out of your house. Siddall is the curator of invertebrates at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and he specializes in things like leeches and parasites, and also in the field of poisons and toxicology.
But he will prove that even things we might think of as yucky or frightening can be fascinating as well when he gives the latest Science on Tap lecture at the Milwaukee Public Museum Thursday. We reached him by phone in New York ahead of that visit. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk.
Happy to be here.
So I think a lot of us in the general society try to stay away from creepy crawly things, parasites, stuff like that when we can. What drew you to them?
As subject matter, it's kind of interesting that, I thought museums of natural history were the places where you put all the stuff that you couldn't put in a zoo because they were too dangerous, like venomous snakes and tarantulas and things like that. But I grew up in a small town in southern Ontario, Canada. We had a ravine across the road from the house. We used to go down there and play with stuff all the time. We used to go on canoe trips and camping trips. And so my experience with things like leeches is something that's very naturally acquired. I got interested in parasites when I was an undergraduate. I was given the opportunity. I ended up just sort of stumbling into a course on parasitology that was taught by a gentleman named Sherwin Besser. And it was, for someone like me who was interested in medicine, it was totally fascinating. Obviously, there's a lot of things like malaria parasites and worm parasites that you get exposed to. But it also opened up some knowledge of the natural world and how no species is really an island unto itself. That there's really a niche of organisms that makes up any individual thing, including humans. There's all kinds of parasites that are just unique to us. And so we can't really be well understood without also understanding the parasites that we harbor and the microbiome that makes us who we are as well.
Well, and at a certain point, after you've studied this for long enough, does it lose its shock quality or its grossness or the kinds of things that most of us attach to it?
I think the grossness, the revulsion, if you will, is something that's learned. And I've got kids of my own, and I do a lot of work on leeches. I like to say that I'm the curator of wormy, slimy stuff at the museum, whether it's leeches or squid or flatworms or what have you. And exposing my kids to those things, exposing is maybe not the right word, but, letting them play with those things as kids, they've got a natural affection for them. I myself had a revulsion, if you will, some trepidation around collecting leeches when I needed to do that for my graduate research when I first started, because I had been probably conditioned going on canoe trips and coming out of the water with a leech on me and not knowing of it. There's that sense of violation of something sucking your blood and you didn't even feel it. And then when you have a parent go, "Oh my God, you've got a leech," then you're being trained that this is a problem. And it's weird, right? Because like nobody does that with a mosquito, because you see the mosquito coming. So I think part of it is actually the not knowing it's coming kind of thing. And not knowing whether you're parasitized or not. That also applies to the issue of poison. Poison is fascinating to people because in terms of things like assassinations or in warfare or just walking through the woods, you don't know it. You don't see it. You don't see poison. You don't see venom until it's too late.
Well, and that's a perfect segue, because I know part of what you're talking about in this Science on Tap lecture touches on the history of toxins and poisons in cultural lore. What are some of the earliest examples of poisons showing up in literature or history more broadly?
Well, in fact, our words for we're used to the word toxic or toxin or pharmaceutical, pharmacon. Interestingly enough, if you go back to Greek literature, a toxin or something that was toxic, the word actually comes from the yew tree. And yew trees were associated with making the bows for bow and arrows because they're really, really flexible. And so a toxin was a substance that was poisonous that you would put on something sharp, like an arrow or a spear or a sword or something like that. Whereas a pharmacon, from which we get the word pharmaceutical, actually was something that you would give as a poison that somebody would eat or drink, like Socrates drinking hemlock. That was a pharmacon. And so those words have come down from ancient Greek in two different ways.
Well, and do I gather that you kind of keep tabs on the use of venom and toxins and such in pop culture today?
I do my best. It goes through phases, interestingly enough. There was quite a bit around the time of the television show Breaking Bad, and even Dexter, There was a character on Dexter who was poisoning people. That was also, you know, the Borgias was a television show that obviously related to the actual Borgias that were very famous for poisoning the people who were in the way of their power. So it waxes and wanes depending on what seems to be popular out there.
And there was also a time that poisons were fairly common weapons of war in say, the Cold War.
Well, certainly. And thankfully, they didn't actually get deployed as much as anybody may have feared. They were definitely deployed quite a bit during the First World War with mustard gases. So chemical warfare actually goes back a very long time. There's an incident that happened when the city of Hatra was under siege by the Romans, and the people in the city of Hatra had run out of things to throw at the Romans who were surrounding the city. What do you do when you've got nothing to throw? Well, they actually sent people out at nighttime to gather up as many scorpions as they could at night, put them in clay pots, and flung those clay pots during the daytime at the advancing Romans, and actually caused the Romans to retreat. That's biological warfare. It doesn't even matter if anybody got stung. They just have to be afraid, which is kind of the way that even a lot of modern weapons of mass destruction operate. It's more about the threat of using them to prevent somebody from coming at you than it is about using them themselves. They do, unfortunately, do get used periodically and to horrific effect.
I think about how journalism is sometimes depicted in movies and pop culture, and I think maybe it's generally gotten better, but as a scientist, can you simultaneously watch, you know, something like Breaking Bad or Dexter or a superhero or sci-fi film for its entertainment value while also deconstructing the science supposedly at work, or do you go straight into the, you know, this is preposterous mode?
You know, I'll be honest with you, it's really entertaining for a scientist when a writer or a producer, director, what have you, when they really get it right, because you're like, wow, yeah, they know it. They got it. Somebody spent the time to maybe talk to a scientist or do the research. And so in contrast, it's always sort of eye-rolling when they don't. The National Academy of Sciences has a program called the Science and Entertainment Exchange, in which they set up situations where writers and directors and producers can get together with scientists over beers or sort of scientific speed dating kind of thing, like they do it in New York and LA and so on, and specifically with the intent of improving the literacy of people who are writing things in Hollywood and or for other purposes. And I think it's doing a terrific job. We really actually, as scientists, do want to get out there and communicate our science and see it leveraged in entertaining ways. We're not always the best at communicating those ideas, but we're trying.
Well, okay, so if you were making a film, what is the overlooked poison you think really deserves a starring role?
Serotonin. I know. So serotonin is what's in your brain, and if you take something like Xanax or Prozac, it's a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and so it's not really thought of as a poison. But if you inject that under somebody's skin, it's one of the most painful things out there. So you could use it to torture people. I don't think you should torture people, but we're talking about a movie here. It's, in fact, one of the major components in wasp stings is serotonin. Huh. And that gets stuck under your skin, and it just drives the neurons wild. It's terrifically painful.
This is almost like a slightly more painful version of the Star Trek phaser on Stun.
Yeah, there you go. There's, you know, if you look at stories, it's amazing how many poisons have been used. A really good example is Agatha Christie. She used just about everything under the sun, from nicotine to strychnine to morphine and so on. I once had a really fun opportunity to go and sit with a group of women, it turns out. They're called Sisters in Crime. They're a club of women who like to write crime stories and mystery stories, and they had me come and talk to them about new ways to off their characters in their stories.
Well, listen, Dr. Mark Siddall, fascinating conversation. I'm sure it will be a fascinating lecture as well. Thank you so much for making some time for us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I'm really looking forward to being in Wisconsin the next few days.
Mark Siddall is curator of invertebrates at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. You can find a link to more information at wuwm.com.